All right, welcome everybody. We might make a start. We're a minute early, but given we've got a pretty full house, I think we can get underway. My name is Peter McCourt, and I'll be chairing this session. So we're going to be hearing from David Gifford and Cassie Citrin and their presentation, which is called Who Am I? The Next Evolution of Client Risk Identification and Segmentation at the TAC. So just to introduce our presenters, firstly, David Gifford. David joined the TAC in 2008 and was appointed to the role of Chief Strategy Officer in January 2016. And this bio is actually a little bit out of date because he's also, because he didn't have enough work to do, he's also taken on the role of Chief Risk Officer as well. So well done to that appointment as well, David. He was previously the Executive Manager of Business Intelligence and Senior Manager of Actuarial Services at TAC, and in that role he led the actuarial work, reporting, analytics and also research functions. Prior to working at TAC, David worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers, where he was a director in the actuarial practice there, and he provided a range of actuarial advice and consulting advice to many of Australia and New Zealand's social insurers and general insurers. More recently, in David's role at the TAC, he's really led a lot of the Strategy 2020 development, which was spoken about at the session this morning, and really about bringing to life TAC's ambitious goal to lead the world in social insurance. And Cassie Citrin, she's currently acting senior strategic analyst in research at the TAC. She's also performed a range of analytical roles at TAC, both in client research and business intelligence teams. She's got a Bachelor of Psychology and is currently undertaking a Master of Data Analytics at Deakin University. I'll now let David and Cassie give you the presentation.
Thanks, Pete. So, first of all, thanks everyone for coming along and filling the room up quite nicely. Hopefully what we've got to share with you is worthy of such a esteemed audience. And so what we are talking about here today is a topic that I think is, well, I'd like to think is really of relevance to... Oh, thanks, Aaron. Where'd you go? They're looking after me. Brilliant. There we go. It's a topic that I guess I'd like to think is of relevance really for all schemes, which is quite simply, how can we identify as early as possible whom of our clients are likely to experience a good recovery or a poor recovery? You know, organisations like the TAC, we've got relatively limited resources to put towards supporting our clients. So as good a job we can do as early as possible in identifying those clients are at risk, it makes a real difference. This is the fourth seminar in a row, going back to 2011, that various people from the TAC have been able to share the work we're doing on this topic. So hence, I guess hence why we're calling this the next evolution of client risk identification and segmentation. I guess the other point I'd like to just really make at the start is what we're presenting here, I guess I'd call it, it's pretty real time. We're presenting some of the work that is literally going on right at the moment at TAC. So what we don't have today, unfortunately, in a way, is a bunch of complete answers. And what we're really going to share with you is a lot of the research that we have done, but probably some of the challenges we're facing as we speak. Nonetheless, I'd like to think that will be of interest. So just very briefly, I'll just start by giving a bit of the strategic context about the TAC, where we're at on our journey that you're broadly aware of, but I'll just dive a little bit more into that. Cassie will talk in a bit more detail about our longitudinal study that we have presented on previously, but there's some extra information or some new information to share in relation to that, and I'll finish off by talking about what's next. So I don't probably need to spend a whole lot of time introducing the TAC. Most of you probably know who we are and what we do. I suppose what's really relevant here is that unlike at least some of the CTP schemes in Australia, still we are a no-fault scheme. So we obviously provide treatment support and compensation on a no-fault basis. And hence we do have a relationship with anyone injured in a transport accident in Victoria. And hence our ability to identify risk and to segment as early as possible and to provide the right types of support and rehabilitation is a critical part of what we do. We're a hybrid scheme, so in addition to the no-fault benefits we provide, we also provide a limited common law benefit. It's a little under 10% of the people injured in transport accidents in Victoria go on to receive common law damages. When it comes to identifying risk and segmentation, that's actually quite an important point because the common law process, as I think was alluded to in a number of the plenary speakers this morning, the common law process, as well as other compensation processes, is a significant impost or can have a significant impact on the way that clients recover. And being able to identify, along with other risk factors early on, who might be likely to go down the compensation path is very important. I'm not actually going to talk about that in any detail today. As I think you all know, the TAC has a significant role in accident prevention, probably what we're best known for in Victoria and probably across Australia is a lot of the marketing campaigns we've had over the years. So just this is the current view of the TAC strategy. And Joe, in the plenary session, hopefully most of you were at that this morning, touched on some of this. I think the I'm not going to talk through it all, but probably the points I wanted to make, the key ones, are those two outcomes that we now have as an organisation. So for most of TAC's history, we've had two headline corporate goals. Up until about 2 years ago, our two headline corporate goals were actuarial release and client experience. Actuarial release, I think most of you understand what that means. It's around how well we manage our liabilities. When we launched our TAC 2020 strategy, we started the work and we launched it about 18 months ago. We moved to these two headline outcomes, towards zero and clients' lives back on track. So they're very deliberately social outcomes. And I guess when we talk about segmenting our clients, when we talk about identifying risk, it's really important to see that through the lens of a particular, obviously the outcome on the right, getting clients' lives back on track. And that if that's what we're really about as an organisation, how we identify risk and therefore how we apply our resources is to achieve that aim. I think that's a really important point and I'll sort of come back to that once or twice as we go. So part of what we did in the strategy was to identify that we really have three critical client groups. And I think there is a lot of alignment actually between the way we're describing our clients and what John Nagle presented this morning in relation to how iCare are thinking. The group at the top, our independence clients, are those who have a severe brain or spinal injury as a result of the transport accident. And we actually started segmenting that group around about 20 years ago. And that, I guess I would regard, and I think there'd be a range of other evidence that would suggest, has been a pretty successful path for us to segment that group. But what we've really had then for most of the 20 years since then is that the other 99% of clients that we've referred to as recovery have, for most of that time, have been treated as one single homogenous group. What the TAC 2020 strategy did that we launched about 18 months ago was to recognise that, in fact, there are two groups of clients within that remaining 99%. The rapid recovery group, who are willing and motivated to recover by themselves without needing active support from the TAC, and where what really we really need to do is just to pay the bills and get out of the way, and the supported recovery group, who need a more active level of support from the TAC. Here's a few numbers that just describe the three client segments, and I guess what There's a few numbers here. It's probably hard to bring through every point, but I suppose what's one thing that's really important is that 19% in the middle, the supported recovery group, they're about 60% of our annual spend. And per claim, they're costing us the better part of $200,000. By contrast, our rapid recovery clients, they're less than 10% of the annual spend and they're costing less than $10,000 each. So before we even talk about outcomes and about what we're trying to achieve for the supported recovery group, they cost us a lot. I guess what we can see also, though, is that the independence group at the top is where the lion's share of our liabilities are. So when we were so focused on actuarial release as a scheme for such a long period of time, we focused a lot on the independence group. When we were focused on client experience, which is a population-weighted survey, not surprisingly, we've probably focused a lot on the rapid recovery group. And I think we would be honest with ourselves that the supported recovery group really slipped between the two. Just a few stats here that sort of highlight some of the differences we see between the supported and the rapid recovery cohorts. Look, I won't go through all of them, but obviously the supported recovery group have a lot more activity on their claims. A lot more of them have pain and mental health issues, cognitive difficulties. And this line down the bottom is a really important one. Life back on track, which I alluded to earlier, is one of our organisational goals. It's also a measure that where we survey our clients annually to ask them on a scale of 1 to 10, to what degree is your life back on track? And not surprisingly, the supported recovery group do a lot worse than the rapid recovery group. Interestingly, and these figures, sorry, are at 12 months post-accident, both groups of clients actually do are still giving us pretty good satisfaction scores at that point. So both are giving us more than 8 out of 10. This is really, I guess I've sort of touched on this earlier, but this just is this is what our measurement framework is now. So as I said earlier, we had actuarial release as one of our headline measures for 20 years. What we now have as our two headline goals, with sort of measures that sit underneath those, are towards zero and clients' lives back on track. Really importantly, we still need to keep our scheme sustainable. I mean, we need to be here for both today's clients and tomorrow's clients. So financial sustainability is still part of our measurement framework, but when we sort of put what are those two headline measures of success, it is the social goals. And so when we make decisions as an organisation, the primary lens through which we make them is around towards zero and lives back on track. And as Joe mentioned earlier, when we look at our values as an organisation, our number one value, we value life, encapsulates both of those goals. Just thought I'd really briefly, I probably could have done this earlier in the presentation, but just give a quick retrospective of how the way that we've segmented our clients over the 30-year journey of our existence. 1997, as I said, was when we first identified our independence clients as a segment, and we created what we then called the Major Injury Division. So we've been doing this for a long time, but I suppose what's really important is that when we did that in 1997, we did that purely and simply because we thought that would help us reduce costs, because at that point, the cost of those major injury claims was very high. So by segmenting that group separately, by having a more focused management, we did control the cost. What we've also seen, fortunately, though, is we've achieved much better outcomes for our independence clients. Over the ensuing years, we have then segmented our within our recovery population to a degree using vocational status and injury. We got a bit fancy with using algorithms and more advanced predictive techniques, as many organisations have. In 2010, we introduced what we called our recovery model, which we presented on previously, which still was a segmentation, though, that was targeting cost. I think it's important to emphasise. And then in about 2013, we actually more formally started to consider client expectations in how we segment. So I guess what I feel we've got here is we do have an evolution of our journey that's considered both the client segments, what the organisation has been focused on. So whereas back here it was just liability that we were focusing on, we've really have started to move through more of a client perspective. And in 2017, and what we'll talk about as we go, or in the remainder of the presentation, is as we now start to think about this, it is really purely and simply about those client outcomes. So with that, I'll hand over to Cass to talk us through the longitudinal a bit more.
Thanks, David. So the longitudinal study, it was really has been one of the foundational resources that we've used to understand client outcomes. And what we've done with it is follow the recovery client, so that was both supported and rapid, which was referred to earlier, through the journey through the TAC scheme after they've been in a transport accident. And the longitudinal study was established with three primary research goals. Those were to measure outcomes, those being health, vocational, and the experience of clients as they recover, and also to identify predictors of those outcomes. So what sort of factors could we identify that impacted those recovery trajectories? And lastly, determine the extent to which the TAC could influence the outcomes. So it's one that's probably slightly more difficult, I think, than the other two, but we're working on it. So the design of the study. So the study was originally designed with four time points. We extended it to five. We started off with 1,566 clients at time one, which is 3 months post-accident, and followed them through at 6, 12, 24 and 48 months, with a retention rate by the 48-month mark of 39%, which we thought was pretty good. So we wanted to understand the different phases of the recovery journey. So at the three-month time point, we actually asked clients to reflect back in time and also understand their pre-accident circumstances, the circumstances of the accident, and their acute response. Then at 6 months, we were looking at really the rehabilitation phase, and then from there, the adaptation and then the stability of their recovery, covering off a variety of questions within those domains under that. So during the sort of development of the 2020 strategy, we really started to put a lens on the identifying the predictors. So what were the major barriers of clients getting their lives back on track? So what we did early on was we looked at all the variables at the three-month time point, so the very earliest point, and we used a principal components analysis to group them all up, and then we regressed those components against life back on track at 12 months after the accident. What we found then was that there were six big primary sort of factors that with sort of various names, needs, complexities, domains, that really predicted poor life back on track outcomes for our clients. And those are probably, you'd be quite familiar with a lot of these, but mental health issues, physical health issues, problems, concerns early with pain, difficulty accessing the external service environment, satisfaction with your treaters and providers. For our scheme in particular, it's also about the accident response. So our clients are frightened. Were they frightened at the time of the accident? Are they having difficulty getting back in the car really early on? And then, again, not unexpectedly, recovery expectations. So there were also another six factors that came out in the PCA that are predictive univariately, so at an individual level, but once we can get a bit of a read on those big six, they're slightly less insightful for a variety of reasons. So not only is it about those big six complexities in isolation, but what we also found was it's the compounding effect of them. So what we've got here is we counted up then the number of complexities that clients experienced at that three-month time point and then had a look at their life back on track ratings 12 months after the accident. And again, unsurprisingly, if you're experiencing issues in four or more of those big six domains, you've got far poorer life back on track outcome sort of objectives than you do anyone who's sort of zero, no issues at all. So that's sort of where we're taking a broader look at needs. One of the earlier pieces of work, and I believe that it was presented at the 2015 conference, was around identifying predictors of mental health and persistent pain. And so that was looking at 6 months. What we have subsequently done when we've identified these factors, so we've got them down the bottom, cognition, resilience, social support and pre-existing mental health, we've actually translated that into claims practice, and we had a small pilot where we asked our staff to ask these questions. It was developed in conjunction with the service catalogue at the time, and subsequently from that we've found that it was really quite powerful. So we've learned a few things, and one was primarily that it could be done, and it could be done really early. I think from the longitudinal study we knew that they were predictors, but at 3 months down the track, so how early could we really ask clients? And it was within the first couple of weeks after the accident. The other was that it action could be taken as a result of identifying these factors, so it enhanced the staff's ability to sort of support our clients. And really, the next sort of, I skipped over a couple of them, but really there were strong graduated differences in the outcomes that we observed of those clients when we followed them up, and stronger than some of the other internal predictive work that we've done. So this, we analysed it against a variety of internal outcomes, but these are just two of them. So what we're looking at here is the screening questions, so stacked. We identify a client sort of whether they had an issue in one of the four screening variables. So you've got 0, 1 or 2 or more on the vertical axis. And then we're looking... So David will talk a little bit about it further on, but we've also done some profiling work to understand the cost and duration of claims, and we've split those into low expected cost and duration and high expected cost and duration. So what's pretty stand out here is that the multiplying effect of understanding those simple four screening questions 2 weeks after the claim just cut through future claim active inactive status, so whether a claim was still on our scheme or not, as well as the likelihood of them requiring psychological services. So we'll see if we can get this to work. One of the other real benefits of the longitudinal study was we were able to get a far deeper understanding of what life back on track meant to our clients. So if this works, which I'm not sure, whether it will. This is just some of the things that our clients said. We also videoed them when we surveyed them about what life back on track means to them.
My life back on track. I definitely be getting back on the bike.
I think my life will be back on track when I feel that driving is just part of my life.
Oh, in 3 months' time, I'll be back to normal. Yeah.
Getting life back on track to me means just getting back to my own independent life.
I'd like to think, in 6 months, but realistically with what I've got, I don't think that's achievable.
In regards to the future, so there's a lot of uncertainty at the moment as to where it is from here.
Talking about getting my life back on track, I'm back where I want to be, except for my headache and my shoulder.
Getting my life back on track is getting back to work full time. That will happen within the next a month or so.
Getting my life back on track means doing all the things I took for granted before. Going down the street, taking the dog for a walk.
I feel that it's improving, so I'm hoping in a way that eventually I can say goodbye to the TAC.
I don't want to get back to how I was before. In a way, I want to get better than that.
Getting my life back on track, I'd like to say I'd like to be able to ride a motorbike again. That's probably, that'll be a confidence issue, I think.
In 3 months' time, I'd like my leg to be healed and starting to go back to work.
So what do I think about getting my life back on track? Realistically, in 3 months, who knows, will I have finished my PhD? But I hope so. I hope that's sort of in the window of time where everything is finally getting back to the step I was just about to reach just before the accident.
So longitudinal study has been an immensely valuable and rich data source for our organisation, and it has helped helped us to design our strategy and understand our clients, which is really, based on all the presentations earlier this morning, the direction that we're really headed. So this 10 minutes doesn't really do it justice, but it's just a really sort of tip of the iceberg of what it had in it. I'll hand back over to David now.
So so where we're at then, we've got the strategy where we're saying we want to get clients' lives back on track. We've got this immense body of longitudinal research underneath it. So what do we do with all that? And as I said at the start, we're still wrestling with some of the questions. So I'm just going to – I'll sort of present to you where we're at. And really what it calls out, I suppose, is some of the – I guess even the dilemmas we face as an organisation in doing that. So this visual here, what it calls out is when we talk about identifying client needs, we've really identified four core domains of information. Sorry if they're a bit hard to read, but just sort of going around the page. There's what we call internal data, which is the data we capture on our system. So the usual sort of stuff, what we capture at acceptance, injuries and so forth. At the top we have client data. So that is what clients tell us, and that's information that we wouldn't have unless we went and asked them those specific questions. There's external health data, which is data that's available to us in the broader health system, but which I guess we would say currently we don't collect. And down the bottom there's this interesting little category called employee insight. Because what and I guess I've sort of got the note next to that, that at the moment a great deal of our segmentation, or at least a proportion of our segmentation, actually happens as a result of employee insight. So how we combine these four domains into the right decision-making framework, that is the challenge as I see it for the TAC and really for any scheme who's trying to do this. What I'm just going to talk about now, though, is just really specifically two of those categories. So as Cass mentioned, we've built what we call service usage profiles that are targeting level of duration of services, so cost. And so that's a prediction mechanism that in our old world, when we're purely and simply, or when we're primarily focused on actuarial release, would be something that would be really important to us. That was developed using cluster analysis and some pretty sophisticated machine learning, and that's built using internal data. And then we have our client complexity, so what we gather using the screening questions. We're not talking about it in detail today, but we've essentially got, from the longitudinal, we've developed six questions that are most predictive of life back on track, developed, again, using principal component analysis and regression analysis, and that's using the client data. So that's what clients have told us in the longitudinal study. So I've just got a couple of charts that then look at how those two data sources come together. And sorry, there's a little bit – they just take a little bit of explanation, but I think it's worth it. So each column here on this chart looks at a group of clients by service usage profile. So this is the group who use very low levels of service, and we can see that within that group, each colour group then represents how clients score on the complexity scale. So the blue group at the top says there's a little less than 20% of the clients with low service usage have high complexity. By contrast, the group who have high service usage, it's nearly 40% have high complexity. So there's a correlation, but it's clearly not a perfect correlation. There's clients with low service usage who are complex, and there's clients with high service usage who aren't complex. When you look at it in absolute numbers, this is the chart on the right here, we can see, though, that in absolute numbers, the blue section, it's nearly 10% of our client group are in that low service usage group but exhibit high levels of complexity. And that absolute number coming out of the low service usage group is pretty similar to the number coming out of the high service usage group. So we're thinking about what segmentation means for TAC in future, and we're thinking how we apply our resources. What we're really about is getting clients' lives back on track. This group here, even though they don't cost us much, are just as important as this group over here who cost us a lot more. And this really, I think, is one of is the real, I guess I would say, challenge we face, because this is quite a different approach to how we've segmented clients in the past. In the past, if they didn't cost us a lot, we put them in a light touch, high volume team. They sat there. We only dealt with them when they contacted us. But if our goal is to get all of our clients' lives back on track, we need to think very differently. This chart, I think, even just maybe brings it through even a little bit more starkly. So what this looks at is the Life Back on Track score at the 4 points in time of our longitudinal study for each combination of service usage, profile and complexity. So the green lines are the three groups who all have low complexity, and they're all giving us roughly 9 out of 10 Life Back on Track. Whereas by contrast, the blue group are the three groups who have very high complexity, and they're giving us roughly 5 or 6 out of 10. So particularly contained within this is that group that I referred to on the previous slide. They cost us relatively little, but they have very poor outcomes. And as I say, our challenge, I think, as an organisation is what's our response to that? Look, we've got a couple more slides on some of the work we're doing right at the moment. I won't spend a lot of time on that in the interest of time. We're currently trialling how we can successfully, having already trialled our mental health and persistent pain screen that Cass referred to, how can we trial this new screening tool that helps identify or that's targeting Life Back on Track? And then we've got a second trial that is, once clients are in the supported recovery division, how can we more specifically target their need? This slide, again, it's really, we just don't have time to do it justice, but we also got ISCA, our research institute, to do a whole scanning piece for us around how other organisations identify need or identify risk. And we've sort of self-assessed, which probably means it's come out a bit more favourable than it should, about how we go against what some of the ISCA recommendations have been. Look, in the spirit of time, I won't go through those in any detail, but look, it's fair to say that their research, I think, just showed that no organisation, as we know, is doing this perfectly. I think at the TAC we're doing reasonably well, but we still know that there is, we can learn from other organisations. This slide is just really making the point of, that identification of need and complexity is not something that's set and forget. We're building the model that we've sort of, or the analysis I'm referring to here is really about what we're calling initial needs identification, which is fairly soon after accident, as Cass mentioned, hopefully within weeks or months. But, you know, these are human beings we're talking about, and their needs change, and, you know, and particularly sometimes as a result of the claims management process. So it's not just about how we identify needs and complexity straight after accident. It's how we do it on an ongoing basis. But I certainly wouldn't say we've got all the answers to that at the moment either. Just thought it was good to finish up with a few reflections around this whole topic. I guess, first of all, that link between what the organisation's goals are and the segmentation is critical. Like I said, I think if we're standing there having this conversation 5 years ago and we're primarily about actuarial release, the way we think about segmenting and applying our resources is very different to how it is today. What's really pleasing for us, as Cass sort of referred to, is that the learnings we've gained from our research, from the longitudinal study, have been able to be successfully translated into claims management practice. So both the way that the clients break down into groups, but then what we actually see in terms of their some of their sort of early outcomes, I suppose, looks quite similar in a claims management setting to what it does in research, which is very encouraging. This sort of the balance, as I said, between different inputs, between the different data sources that we need to put towards that segmentation is critical. And as I said, we haven't got it figured out yet, but that's what we're wrestling with at the moment. This sort of fourth point here, that all we've really talked about today is this sort of is what we how we identify the risk, how we do the segmentation. What you actually do once we've actually segmented and put clients into different claims management models in a lot of ways is far more important than the segmentation itself. But we haven't sort of addressed that topic at all today. The topic of many future presentations, no doubt. And really, I think most importantly of all, which if there's a single insight that we've gained, it's that if what we're about as an organisation is client outcomes, that really most simply what the clients tell us is probably going to be the most important information. So whatever we can do to gather that insight from them as effectively as possible is really the key to us being successful and being able to help them get their lives back on track. And there's just a little quote we thought we'd finish with that sort of wraps up the complexity and the multidimensionality of what it is we're trying to do here. So thanks, everyone. That's where we're at.
Thanks, Dave and Cassie. We've got about 5 minutes for questions. So if you have a question, can you please use the microphone because the session is being recorded?
Very good question, I'll ask. When you did the longitudinal study and you asked the questions, was it TAC who did it or did you have an independent party? And then my subsequent question is, do you think there's any bias in the responses that people give because of who asked the question or where they are in the claiming process?
Can I answer the easy one and get Cass to answer the hard one, please? The easy one is that, yes, we did have an external research provider who did the research. My simplistic answer to the second one, as I said, is that we've seen when we've asked essentially pretty similar questions in the field as what we asked in research is pretty similar outcomes. So simplistically, I would say no. I'm not sure if you wanted to... if you wanted to give a better answer to that.
I think that was one of my big concerns as well, that if we're the TAC is asking questions, clients might have a different response. I think the clients are actually really open with us and honest with us, and they'll tell us when they're having problems usually. It's just that we don't have a mechanism to capture it. Probably the biggest challenge that we're finding is getting the staff to ask questions consistently and the staff to hold their sort of judgment and appraisals until they've given each client the opportunity to answer. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, we didn't really talk at all today about some of the challenges with, I guess, with the staff. I think we sort of skated over it, certainly with the mental health persistent pain screen. We were able to implement that fairly successfully. We're probably to be honestly seeing a few more challenges with the trials that we're running at the moment with with just getting the staff's trust in the questions. But in terms of, as I say, I think at the simplistic level, in terms of the bias, I think we've probably seen enough that we think if we ask our questions in the right way, there shouldn't be a bias. Another
finished
question.
Sorry, yeah,
that's
all right. I'll go to this mic. It's closer. Sorry. So you mentioned that part of your segmentation or part of the information base that you use is your employee insights, which I thought was pretty amazing. What sort of correlation are you getting between what they're saying as being complex and what's coming out of the survey?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't say that the way that we're using insight at the moment is quantitative in a way that would allow it to be correlated. I guess it's more a reference to the fact that, inevitably by looking at internal data and asking the screening questions, that will explain so much of the variability and that employee insight will sometimes add value over and above that. I think the important point I would make is that when we use employee insight, that the judgment of the staff needs to be done in a robust way so you can actually capture the reasons why they're applying their insight. As I say, at the moment, we use a lot of employee insight, but in a really, really unstructured way. And so to the extent that we have employees who do a better or a worse job, we have no sort of systematic way of seeing that. So to be able to do what you described, though, would be fantastic, to actually be able to have a kind of a sort of a more systematic opinion, I suppose, that we capture from our staff. We're not there yet.
Perhaps a similar question to Aaron's, but from the kind of injured person's perspective, how reliable is their insights on that life back on track score towards the kind of the services and the outcomes they're getting from the perspective of kind of cost of claims and the number of services and the length of those services?
So you mean, like, what's the relationship between them saying their life's back on track versus their need for ongoing services or not?
Quite simply is when they perceive that things are improving for them, is that being reflected in other activities?
Look, certainly what we sort of didn't really, again, have any time to present today, but we've done a whole lot of analysis that looks at the relationship between the life back on track measure and a whole range of both other client-reported outcome measures as well as a whole lot of internal data. And there is a strong correlation between, you know, better life back on track, lower cost. Now, it's not like it's never perfect. There'll be some clients who say their life's back on track that are still costing us more, and some who say it's not who are costing us less. But there certainly is a strong correlation. I guess that's why, you know, we've had this measure now, I guess, within the organisation for 5, 6, 7 odd years, and why it just still continues, even though, as far as we're aware, we're the only organisation who actually uses this measure, it just continues to work for us because it just correlates so well with everything else.
All right. That is the bell. That means that we need to end. So can I just ask you to thank Dave and Cassie once more for their presentation.